Hello and welcome to the Law and Guidance podcast, where we are talking about the actual law, pure law, and guidance concerning various topics with me, Sally Penny, MBE. This week I have a guest who is Professor Penny Cooper, brilliantly and well known as an expert on the use of intermediaries in criminal cases and beyond. But of course, intermediaries and special measures are not just restricted to the criminal courts where I practice. So I'd like to welcome, please, Professor Penny Cooper. Hello, Penny.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Sally.
No problem at all. Penny, I want to kind of start from the beginning, if I may, really, and remind myself, actually, of where you're based and your brilliant expertise, really. Are you at City still?
No, I'm not. That was my first move into academia when I left the bar. But I'm still part of the University of London, but I'm part-time in a wholly research role at the Institute for Crime and Justice Policy Research at Birkbeck, and also a door tenant at 39 Essex.
Brilliant. Now, you are quite a renowned expert on the use of intermediaries. How did that come about, before I ask you specifically about special measures for vulnerable witnesses and vulnerable defendants and adult complainants in sexual offences and so on? How did you become you are the world leading expert.
Well, it was by chance, really. What had happened was, in 2002, I moved to City after the best part of a decade practicing. I moved into education. I'd been doing some teaching along the way, so it wasn't a wholly massive jump.
Yes.
But when I was at City University, the law school there, newly recruited, heading up a department, the Ministry of Justice, well, actually its predecessor, Office for Criminal Justice Reform, the bit that was looking after vulnerable witnesses then, approached the university and they said, look, we want to bring in Section 29, the intermediary part of special measures. Have you got anyone there who might be able to design a course for us? The inquiry got routed to me and I thought, well, this sounds very interesting. And it really intrigued me, partly because my background in practice was some crime, but towards the end of my practice, more specialising in child protection cases.
Yes.
And I'd been teaching expert witnesses as well. I thought, well, this is a really new creature. They're not expert witnesses. They're not social workers. They're not witness supporters. Really interesting. So, long story short, I designed something for them, won the tender, recruited to my team so that we could meet the needs of the Office for Criminal Justice Reform and then subsequently the Ministry of Justice, because the demands of us became greater. It was a good thing because the scheme was taking off. It had gone from this tiny little pilot to eventually, a few years later, being rolled out nationally. And, of course, the Ministry of Justice needing more support by that stage because there were so many more intermediaries and so much and a much greater demand for them in the courts.
Yes. Now, the special measures generally are governed by the Youth and Criminal Justice Evidence Act 1999, which is a statute which also affords anonymity for young persons and so on. So the original provisions are tied up in there. But in court, as an advocate, as I am specialising in crime and other areas, I'm concerned, particularly prosecuting, on achieving the best evidence rule.
Yeah.
And I am also, when defending, that, particularly young people who are accused persons with needs or difficulties are able to tell their version of what occurred or what's alleged to have occurred so that a jury and a judge understands them. And I think those are the principles of the use of intermediaries and the requirement of special measures, which can vary from having a screen to prevent a witness from perpetrator in the dock to various other means. And intermediaries are one of those measures, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. And I agree with you. We're all interested in, all us practitioners and judges, achieving the best evidence, aren't we? That's, if we're not trying to do that in court, what are we there for? And, of course, achieving best evidence is the name of the lengthy guidance now that police officers follow where they interview witnesses.
Yes.
And I guess if you can look at it this way, practitioners in courts, we've got the legislation, that's our starting point, 8 special measures, one of which is the intermediary. And it was one of the last ones to be brought in. So you've mentioned screens already, live link and removal of wigs and gowns, those sorts of things. Actually, by the time intermediaries started rolling out 2004 for the very first cases, those other special measures I've just mentioned, they were pretty well known about, weren't they?
Yes, they were. And, you know, we've become more quite accustomed to their use, really. Whereas I know that, you know, you've been assisting Tasmania, for example, in Australia, who are just about to introduce them or are piloting them presently. And I'm going to talk about the objections to their use and the feeling that advocates can have that they're not able to properly put their case in the traditional adversarial way in a moment, but they can. So just tell us really, what are intermediaries? Because they're not volunteers, are they?
No, they're not. They're officers of the court. They're established through statute, at least in crime, the Youth Justice and Criminal Evidence Act, Section 29. You mentioned Tasmania. In fact, what happened is when they were brought in England and Wales, a few years later, Northern Ireland approached me and said, do you think you could come over here and help us introduce them in Northern Ireland? At which point I inwardly thought, what on earth do I know about Northern Ireland? It's, you know, it's all a mystery to me. But I read up around it, went over on a little recce visit, met senior judges and practitioners who were really welcoming. And then actually after that, after Northern Ireland, Australia approached me. I've been over several times from 2016 onwards, helped New South Wales, helped Canberra. Now at a distance, obviously, because of the pandemic, have helped Tasmania introduce intermediaries. I've even been to Chile, which is interested in our model and has introduced something there. I've probably missed off a country. But I think the point is, what we did here in 2004 was pretty innovative, because the intermediary, if you look at the legislation, reads a bit like an interpreter, like somebody is going to be repeating the question to the witness and then repeating the answer back.
Yes.
But given a pretty much a blank sheet of paper to design the training course back in 2002, I thought that's going to be a bit odd and clunky and potentially patronising to a witness. Wouldn't it be better, I thought, if the intermediary assessed the communication needs of the witness and then facilitated questioning by advising the advocate, you know, do it this way, or the police officer in interview, suggesting ways that they could best communicate. And also, I think importantly, the role being one where they sit in court next to the witness, having established these ground rules, and only intervene if they're needed. So that's why I call it a facilitator role, as opposed to someone who's coming in and saying, okay, step aside, questioners, I'll do the questioning. That's not how it works in England and Wales, and it has worked. And I think that's why the jurisdictions have got interested and said, we'd like to do it here. And Australia was very much the sort of rollout of it prompted by the findings of, they had a Royal Commission into Institutional Sexual Abuse.
Yes.
Gave evidence at that in 2016 in Sydney. And one of the recommendations was that intermediaries were rolled out across the other states. And at the time, I was there to help New South Wales introduce it as a pilot. So, you know, it's been a success, I think, because there are many, many instances, many people saying, people are giving evidence who wouldn't have been able to before. Or to quote somebody I interviewed once for a piece of research, there were many witnesses who up to that point were priced out of the justice system.
Yes, they were. And, you know, and witnesses who have several needs, or perhaps witnesses who may have Down syndrome, or, you know, whatever the syndrome, what the issue was.
Yeah. Or just age, just, you know, being 3 or 4. Because, you know, wonderful intermediaries like the late Ruth Marchant were spearheading really the growth in knowledge about very young children and their capabilities. So a 3 or 4 year old could give evidence with the support of an intermediary. Whereas I would say probably until intermediaries started doing that, the general idea was, you know, any any child, any witness below five, run a mile. You know, that was the kind of attitude.
Yes. Now, I want to, we've evolved, certainly in the UK, and I'm really proud that we've been leading on this, actually, throughout and with your assistance. And certainly, you know, I have taught on that course from an advocate's perspective.
Yes, you've been great. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, probably try to demonstrate the different styles as well of the advocate asking the question. Yeah. And the case law on this has evolved somewhat. And the most well-known or recent case was reported in 2014 and reported actually in the Weekly Law Report in 2015, which was Lubemba and were before Mrs. Justice Hallett, who's retired now from the Court of Appeal. And my favourite line from that case is, advocates must adapt to the witness, not the other way round, which I just love because I think that all too long, you know, witnesses have had to adapt to the advocate asking questions. And if they can't answer, just sort of fumble or whatever else. But more importantly, it's not just a criminal court, is it? Because I've been reviewing the legislation. The Equality Act 2010 demands substantive equality for every person appearing in a court to ensure their full participation, provides that the court has safeguarding responsibilities in respect of children and vulnerable adults, often discharged through judicial discretion. And then Bar Standards, who regulate barristers, has published a list of competencies that every barrister is expected to have from the outset in acting in proceedings in all cases heard in the youth court and involving defendants of the 18 in the magistrates' courts where they're tried and the higher courts. And so, and then of course, the equal equal treatment bench book for judges, which had a comprehensive chapters on child and vulnerable and disabled witnesses, are essential reading for advocates, and the Advocates Gateway, which endorses and represents the practice contained in the practice direction, and in Lubemba about conduct. So it's not just in the criminal courts per se, is it? Even though that's where we have been leading, and our colleagues in the family courts are soon catching up. Just summarise for us, really, why was Lubemba so, I mean, I can tell you from an advocate's point of view, but why was it so groundbreaking, do you think?
Well, I think it's that very line that you've mentioned. It's also my favourite line in Lubemba, advocates must adapt to the witness, not the other way around. To me, it's striking in its simplicity and its clarity, but it's also striking because, as you say, against the backdrop of the Equality Act and the Disability Discrimination Act before that, to get to 2014 for the Court of Appeal to feel they need to say that, make that point very clearly, it tells you a little bit, doesn't it, about, I think it does anyway, about the culture of the courtroom and how I think it was lagging behind the rest of the legally compliant world in England and Wales. Because, of course, you probably know this in the Equality Act, there's this exception, which means that what goes on in court doesn't fall within the remit of the Equality Act and the requirement to make reasonable adjustments in the same way that it would, say, if, you know, you were running a cafe or an office or something.
Yes, it's weird.
It is weird, but, you know, there it is. And I think that the courts have caught up now because we've got that in Lubemba. And I was also pleased to see that, and it was pretty exciting at the time, that Lady Justice Hallett, Vice President, as she then was, recommended the Advocates Gateway as well. So it was a really good moment because the work that I and lots of other people have put into forming toolkits that were research-based but really sort of practical in their guidance, they were endorsed by the Court of Appeal when she made that comment.
Yes. But there is a flip side to this, isn't it? If it were a coin, forgive the analogy, that advocates feel that as if the state is somewhere, or the stakes are awaited in favour of the Crown and the state in using intermediaries, as if, you know, they're participating and preventing defendants from having a fair trial, if you like. And the Court of Appeal has stressed in various cases, haven't they, the wide range of special measures available has not altered the court's responsibility for the fairness of the trial. Yeah. Trial judges are expected to deal with specific communication problems faced by defendants or witnesses as part of the ordinary control of the judicial process. And that goes back as far as Cox in 2012 and F in 2013. But really, what I wanted to ask you about, this idea that advocates can feel sometimes that they're being prevented from the true adversarial system, most of which has died a death now, really. And that was originally the objection, wasn't there, to using toolkits, you questioning in a certain way, and the use of intermediaries. Did you ever feel that? And even from that's from a defence point of view, of course. But even defendants need to be afforded the assistance of an intermediary.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it really didn't help the fact that under the legislation in England and Wales, the accused was specifically excluded.
Yes.
So you could have a person 1 week as a witness getting an intermediary, but that same person the following week, if they were the accused, not getting an intermediary. And it's clearly not right. So, you know, you can understand starting at that point why defence barristers would feel things were a little bit, you know, loaded one way.
Yeah.
Of course, then subsequently, we know now, and it's well established in law, that the accused can get an intermediary when the judge invokes their inherent jurisdiction. It's still not as good as having legislation, because where there's legislation, all sorts of other things follow, like funding and standards.
Mm.
But anyway, that's, you know, that's a whole other debate that David Wurzel and I wrote about in an article called A Day Late and a Dollar Short. And I think it was about 2013 or 2014. And despite plenty of other recommendations, Law Commission reports and things like that, we're still at the position where the accused is not covered by the legislation. But it is in Northern Ireland. So, you know, we're actually second rate compared to Northern Ireland. And then your other point really about feeling, you know, things are loaded against the accused because, I mean, you were talking about traditional advocacy, I think, being thwarted.
Yes.
Well, that was sort of the idea that you wanted me to touch on. Well, what can I say about that? I can say this. I was taught advocacy the way many of us were taught advocacy, and I became an advocacy tutor as well in this Hample method with
yes.
those sort of headlines. Do you remember the headlines?
Because I'm an advocacy tutor even now. Yeah. So, yes.
Yeah. Tell, don't ask, lead, never let the witness explain, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Well, they don't work for vulnerable witnesses, those kind of things. If you've got someone who's compliant or suggestible or having difficulty deconstructing a tag question to make sense of it, those sorts of traditional things that we're taught for cross-examination, they clearly don't work, and they need to be adjusted, whether it's for a witness or whether it's for the accused. The other thing that I'd say, which is slightly more controversial, but oh, so backed up by research, is that those sorts of techniques aren't really any good for anybody. The psychological research that we have tells us that when you use those traditional techniques of cross-examination, you're less likely to get complete and accurate evidence. But, you know, we have to accept that cross-examination in some ways is not about getting the best evidence, is it? It's about putting the case.
Yes.
And you need to put the case to the witness, not because you, as the cross-examiner, have a right to do so, but because you have a duty to your client and because the witness has a right to respond to your challenges. You know, if they're saying it was daytime and you're saying it's nighttime, you need to put that to them and give them the chance to respond. So where does that all lead us to? I mean, it leads us back to your point about achieving best evidence.
Yeah.
You have got to put the question in a way that's most likely to enable a witness to understand it so that they can exercise their right to respond. And for some witnesses, you need an intermediary to support that, and, you know, other witnesses, you don't. But there's no place for questions that are purely designed to confuse or intimidate. And the professional guidance, that backs that up.
Mm. It's interesting, isn't it? Because when one looks at the statistical evidence on, you know, the fears that work at concerning the use of them, that, you know, you would get more convictions, for example. Some people feared that, you know, there would be more incorrect or wrongful convictions. Isn't necessarily backed up. You know, the convictions in rape cases, you know, from the point of view of the Crown, are still not great. In fact, I think that there's a judicial review, isn't it, against the CPS about decisions to not pursue sexual offences, for example. And so it hasn't been a sort of mass increase in conviction rates in certain types of offences, are they, involving certain types of witnesses? So that alleviates that concern. But the actual intermediaries themselves are often psychologists, aren't they? They're often...
Well, more likely speech and language therapists, but
yeah,
some are psychologists. I've got a fascination with psychology, so I hang around. They're my kind of tribe, the intermediaries who are psychologists. I think, the important thing is that they really know their stuff when it comes to facilitating communication.
Yeah.
It's not as simple as turning up and trotting out a few bland and well-known do's and don'ts, like don't ask tag questions, slow down, and have regular breaks. I think the really good intermediaries, they add more than that to a case.
Yes, no, they do. And of course, we know there's a shortage of them, because certainly when they first came, you would struggle to get an intermediary that you wanted. And I know some more have been trained. But I wanted just to be fair to the judges that my experience, whether in the lower courts with youths charged with very serious offences to the Crown Courts and higher, is that actually judges try to accommodate the needs of defendants as much as possible. I have quite a serious case coming up to be tried where, you know, they've applied the best evidence rule because this particular young person has, you know, needs of his own. So that there is an effort to try and establish and make sure that those accused also have a fair trial. But I wanted to ask you, Penny, about other areas, at the specialist areas.
Yeah.
And I know you were involved in quite an interesting case, weren't you? And I've been interested in use of intermediaries in the employment courts, for example, with people with various needs, sometimes physical, sometimes, you know, neurological difficulties, which has affected their performance and then, ended up in dismissals. So it's been good to bring my criminal skills across there. But what cases have you been involved in, sort of non-crime? I wonder if you can just share without disclosing.
Yeah, without the details, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in general, let me talk about family courts first. Although I've not been involved in cases in family courts since I was a practitioner many years ago, I was involved in the working group. And I've been involved in research in the family courts, and my work's been cited in family cases. Because back in, this is going back a good few years now, again, maybe about 2013, 2014, it sounds like a real name drop now. I bumped into James Mumby it was a publisher's party at Inner Temple, you know, as you do, you bump into the president of the family court. And I said, you know, we'd really love to do a toolkit on the Advocates Gateway for family cases. What do you think? And he said, well, funny you should say that, because I've been thinking that we're lagging behind the criminal courts. Yes, we're really interested in a toolkit. And I'm putting together, he said, this working group to look at the equivalent sort of adjustments that there could be for vulnerable people in the family courts. So I sat on that group. It was co-chaired by Ms. Justice Russell, Ms. Justice Hayden, and we made a number of recommendations, and these things take time, as you know. But 2017, the family courts brought in participation directions and a practice direction. And I want to stress that, because I think it's a good example for all sorts of different areas. You don't have to, and judges won't, those that have been have influence in policy terms. You don't have to, and judges don't wait for the legislation to come in, because, you know, if you were waiting for legislation, you could be waiting decades, frankly.
Yes.
But you can address this through practice directions. You mentioned the Employment Tribunal. I've been doing some research in the Employment Tribunal about witness evidence, and there was a vulnerable witness practice direction that came, or practice guidance, it might be that, it came from the outgoing president at the end of last year. I've been involved in advising in cases. There was one notable case in the civil courts where there was an attempt to bring in an intermediary that was not successful, but I advised on a range of special measures. The equivalent of, if you like, special measures in the civil court for that claimant. That was a personal injury case. And the claimant had significant difficulties as a result of a head injury. These difficulties that meant there would need to be adjustments if she were cross-examined. The case settled in the end, but I think that's the first case cited in the White Book, Brown, yeah. Widgeable, about special measures in the civil courts. Now, that was what? That must be a couple of years ago now. This, the civil courts, is it this month or round about now? They're bringing in new practice directions for vulnerable witnesses in the civil court. So all these areas are playing catch up and doing it in their own way, however they can. And that has to be as a result of it coming from judges. You know, this is not legislation, this is not parliament, this is Civil Justice Council, for example, deciding yes. that this needs to be brought in. So all credit to the judges and those who work with them to bring in these changes. You know, the policy is changing behind the scenes.
Yes, absolutely. And also, particularly in a time where we are having more and more people unrepresented. Mm. You know, now more than ever, I think it's become really pertinent and also therefore will involve judges being able to manage those cases properly and in a certain way. So the provisions in the civil courts and vulnerable witnesses were supposed to have come in a bit sooner, weren't they? But for COVID. So I did notice they were delayed slightly at the time of recording. So I'm looking forward to that. Sorry.
Is it the 6th of April? Is that when they're coming in? Anyway, so it's something to look up. You can look it up on Gordon Exel's civil litigation brief. He's done one or two articles on it there.
Yes. No, I have. Look, I was following it and then it went a little quiet. Can I ask then, Penny, really, what do you think is next for intermediaries and, you know, vulnerable witnesses in the courts? You know, we've got anonymity, we've got quite a lot of provisions, certainly in the criminal courts. And I'm glad it's rolling out. What do you think is next? Because one of the areas I'm interested in is, for example, autism. And particularly accused persons with autism and their behaviour after arrest and in interview and, you know, inferences being drawn, for example, at a trial where they failed to give an account on an issue, and just ensuring there's fairness in that sort of context, and equally witnesses who have got, you know, a range of autistic issues, and ensuring they are able to participate effectively in a trial and indeed in the best evidence rule. So I just wondered where you saw it going, because we're now in Section 28, which are pre-recordings.
Yeah.
Pre-recordings, that was a pilot, wasn't it? Liverpool Crown was one of the courts and a pilot there. And that's going national. Certainly in my local courts, on our circuit, that's going big, as it were, where the recordings for cross-examination are pre-recorded and then just played at trial. So, yeah, I just wondered where you saw intermediaries going, where it could evolve around, really, bearing in mind quite a few countries now have adapted to our way of thinking.
Well, intermediaries specifically, where I think that's going, and this is not just a wild guess, but based on information that the Ministry of Justice has been putting out, there's a possibility that intermediaries, instead of being self-employed as they are now, the Ministry of Justice develops a scheme where they have employed intermediaries and they cover more than, at the moment, witnesses in criminal cases. Because although you can get an intermediary, for example, in a family case or an employment case or for the accused in a criminal case, at the moment you're not doing it through the registered intermediary scheme because the legislation was set up just for witnesses in criminal cases, and that's all that registered intermediaries from the Ministry of Justice do now. But, yeah. Of course, people who have qualified as intermediaries, they provide services in all those other types of cases that we've been talking about, but they're not through the Ministry of Justice, and so that brings issues like fees and regulation and budgeting.
And quality.
And yeah, exactly, quality. So that's where I think intermediaries are likely to go, a broader scheme, but perhaps with employed intermediaries as opposed to self-employed intermediaries, and the Ministry of Justice having a better grip on it, or a grip on it, really, because at the moment they don't have a grip on the provision outside of the registered intermediary scheme. So that'll be interesting to see. I think there'll be continuing interest from other jurisdictions. I had a conference today, a telephone Zoom call with a representative from Bosnia today. I get these calls every now and again from jurisdictions. People find me online and say, oh, you know, would you be interested in coming in and helping us doing some training here? So that's exciting, and it always feels really worthwhile doing those sorts of things. I think where other areas in relation to vulnerable witnesses are going, well, where I'd like them to go is I'd like there to be mandatory training at pre-qualification level, rather than cross-examination being taught in the traditional way. I know they're bringing in, or they have brought in, vulnerable witness teaching on the bar course. I would like to see a lot more attention paid to psychological research and sort of joining up what we know is right for vulnerable witnesses with what is taught for these robust adult witnesses. You're not seeing these two things as separate.
Yes.
Not least because, I don't know if you've had cases like this, but many times in recent years, because I've been more open to asking and giving people more time to share, I've been amazed at the number of witnesses who will let you know something shortly before they give evidence, maybe 2 or 3 weeks before they give evidence. And you think, crikey, that is something that potentially is adjusting for. And yet they haven't mentioned it before, even though they might have been involved for years, or at least, you know, a year or so in preparing for the trial. Do you know the sort of thing I mean? And somebody just goes, well, actually, I'm an insulin-dependent diabetic. And you think, you know, blimey, if this gets to 5 o'clock, or no, 4:30, and the judge goes, well, let's press on, shall we? It shouldn't be down, should it, to the witness to sit there and think to yourself, is this now the moment when I disclose that I actually need to have a break now and check my blood sugar? Do you know what I mean?
Yes, yes. And it's only as we started this podcast by me talking about best evidence rule, wasn't it? But that will affect it because, you know, we have to be very real to the fact that there is a backlog in all the courts, particularly in the criminal justice system. I don't want to talk about the causes of it. That's not what this podcast is about. But as we all try to, you know, work through and deal with, quite rightly, access to justice and ensure fair procedures and so on, those will be some of the things we will be sitting. We've already seen in the Nightingale courts and the early hearing courts, we will be sitting earlier and sitting later. And we have to be alert to people's needs. And yes, no, I have had those. You know, I'm quite good at actually asking the questions very early. Can you just establish whether there are any, you know, issues or problems, even simple things like reading? It's astonishing. The number of people who can't, you know, who actually can't read. And then they say, well, I've forgotten my glasses, or, you know, and then there are signs that you can look for. So, no, I do know what you mean.
Yeah. And then there's a whole remote hearing thing, isn't there?
Yes.
And, you know, there are undoubtedly pros and cons for everybody. If we look at witnesses in particular, you know, just in light of what we've just been talking about, does it make it less likely that you might build enough rapport with somebody to find out the sort of things that might impair their participation? I don't know. Is it better for most witnesses? Do they feel less anxious? Do they give better quality evidence if they're giving it remotely? I don't know. You know, there are so many different factors, because if they're stuck at home and they're anxious about the doorbell going or the dog rushing in or something like that, then it isn't necessarily less worrying for them than going to court and giving evidence in a live link room or even in the courtroom. There's so much we don't know.
Yeah.
That has to be on the agenda. Research about remote hearings and what it means for, let's come back to it, the quality of the evidence.
Yes. Oh, yes. Maybe we need to get that rolling, actually, Penny.
I keep banging on about it. I think, I'm having discussions with Lord Justice Ryder. Well, he's not Lord Justice Ryder now, is he? He's retired. But as a director of the Nuffield Foundation, he's hosting a forum, I think it's next week. So that will be one of the things I'll be banging on about there. And hopefully there'll be lots of it, you know, really enthused researchers, because it needs people to come together as a team. It needs people who know about sociology and psychology and speech and language, you know, and law. But it's not the sort of topic that I think lawyers can say, we're clever enough to know all about this and sort it all out ourselves, much as we like to sometimes. We've got to work collaboratively with other disciplines.
Yes. No, I do agree with you, because there is something about how things are said in court, and not just what is said. You know, we work in evidence, don't we? It's not just what is said, it's how it's said and the nuances. And many of us are concerned about those being lost by virtue of using a screen. You know, if somebody says, I didn't know there were Class A drugs smuggled into my case, or, you know, in a yam when I used to do a lot of drug mule case.
Yeah.
And then you feel the yam, and the officers bring the drugs to court, and you think, my goodness, how on earth could you not have known that, you know, and the jury get to inspect it and so on and so forth. That's very different, isn't it, to giving evidence through the postage screen. Having said that, I must say, declare, I'm not entirely anti, per se, trials or some minor trials being conducted. You know, if the research shows that some actually would work, and it would be less of a difficulty. Because we've all conducted cases now where we've had people giving evidence internationally from other jurisdictions, you know, from Caribbean to India, and it's been via Skype. And FaceTime, we've had, you know, evidence given like that to the UK. So it's not entirely unusual. But it does concern me that that should become the norm. And so I'm very interested in what the research says about all of that. So please keep me posted. And finally, really, I just wanted to ask you about Tasmania and but not the devil, but how they're getting on with introducing intermediaries over there.
Well, they've only been going for about a week, so I think it's probably a bit early to tell. I would have gone out Easter time last year, but of course COVID struck, so I didn't do another jaunt down under. But it was really brilliant that I was able to engage people like you and others to do some podcast interviews. The tables were turned on occasions, and I was interviewing you and a couple of judges, and talking about how the intermediary scheme had developed here, because that was part of the learning for the new intermediaries there. But isn't it wonderful? But also, I love the fact, actually, that originally the idea for intermediaries came out of Western Australia, where there's a little bit written about it. There'd only ever been one case where they'd used an intermediary. I'm not even sure how that intermediary was used. But it was picked up by the people who were writing the recommendations that led to our legislation, sort of found out about this Western Australian one case. So isn't it lovely that it's sort of come all the way around the world and then gone back there? There's something beautifully circular about it.
Yes, absolutely. I think sometimes, you know, we are an island, of course, aren't we here? But we've got a lot of weight, and it is wonderful to sort of keep in line with other systems. Australia, of course, you know.
Yeah, we can all learn from each other, can't we?
Yeah, you know, in the Commonwealth and common law jurisdictions, it's quite interesting. Well, Penny, thank you very much for coming on the Law and Guidance podcast. It's been really interesting and useful to discuss the law governing intermediaries and vulnerable witnesses. I hope that you've enjoyed it and found it useful.
Oh, it's been really enjoyable chatting to you, as always. Did I pass? Was I okay?
Of course, it's so, so interesting. So,
like a flipping PhD viver.
Yes, you've only written several books and you're only a professor on the subject. Yes, quite. You've just passed. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.